Speaking on behalf of the American Sexually Transmitted Disease Association is both an honor and a difficult task. ASTDA is the nation's professional association of STD practitioners and researchers, and I currently serve as the ASTDA Vice President. Founded in 1948, our mission is to support the control, prevention, and ultimate eradication of STD, to support research in all aspects of STD, including medical, epidemiologic, laboratory, social, and behavioral studies, to recognize outstanding contributions in STD control and prevention, and to disseminate authoritative information concerning STD. The association publishes the highly regarded journal Sexually Transmitted Diseases, and we are a proud co-sponsor of the National STD Prevention Conference. So it is with both pride and humility that I accept the responsibility of offering our organization's voice to the national commentary on the Guatemala STD studies and allowing us to begin a process of introspection and soul-searching as it pertains to our professional past and future. And this is our ASTDA web page, and I hope you'll all consider joining the organization. As we have seen here this morning, these studies from Guatemala violated the most basic fundamental ethical principles of autonomy and respect for human dignity. Whatever the underlying rationale, it is hard to imagine any justification whatsoever for the manner in which these studies were undertaken, or the great lengths that were taken by so many within the public health chain of command to keep them from public scrutiny. Let me go on record, speaking just for myself for the moment, to say that I think these studies are truly reprehensible, nauseating, unquestionably wrong on so many levels. You don't have to be a bioethicist to know that intentional abrasion, scarification of the penis, cisternal puncture, and other inoculation techniques performed on psychiatric patients without their consent are shocking, shockingly, unquestionably wrong. Reading this section of the Presidential Commission made me feel nauseated, literally. I felt sympathy for the psychiatric patient who, quote, fled the room after being subjected to scarification of the penis, scarification being intentional abrasion with the application of infectious material, a technique which Dr. Cutler felt was, quote, a heroic challenge method, which was justified as a means to provide more rigorous experimentation to improve the likelihood of syphilis transmission after experimental exposure. And here are some pictures of the patients. I know we've seen some of these before from the report, but just showing you the intensive documentation. And who among us is not appalled, as we just saw from Dr. Solmazy, to learn of intentional intracisternal inoculation, withdrawing 10 cc's of cerebrospinal fluid from the base of the skull, and then injecting spirochetes directly into the central nervous system. No detail was too small. Nothing was left to chance. About 5 cc's of withdrawn spinal fluid was then re-injected, and I quote, to wash the spinal needle to ensure a complete dose of spirochetes. No evidence indicates that these patients understood they were being involved in an experiment, and in many cases, as we've seen, there is no record of adequate treatment after infection. EGADS. I came of age, as did we all, well after Nuremberg, and this seems like something right out of Dr. Mengele's notebook. Simply vile. However, my task today is not to provide just my own personal reflections, but rather a response on behalf of the ASTDA in order to gauge the sense of our membership on this issue. I undertook a qualitative assessment of the views and perspectives of past and present ASTDA members of the ASTDA Executive Committee, comprised mostly of physicians and research scientists who are committed to ASTDA's mission of advancing our understanding of STDs and elected by the ASTDA general ASTDA membership. The Executive Committee offers a window on the world of how ASTDA members are reacting to our emerging knowledge of this very difficult chapter in our history. I think we have all worked through and dealt with, to one extent or another, the legacy of Tuskegee, which is reprehensible in its own right. This adds yet another ugly layer with which we will have to contend professionally for the remainder of our careers. So the ASTDA Executive Committee is, I believe, a fairly good expositor for the organization at large. In expressing their views about this, I found absolute unanimity of opinion among ASTDA Executive Committee members that the Guatemala STD studies were repulsive, unjustified, and unjustifiable in all respects. Horrific, unacceptable, terrible, condemnable, inexcusable, these are some of the adjectives that ASTDA leaders use in describing this work. It is heartening for our organization and for our field, in fact, that the ASTDA lines up squarely and unequivocally against this sort of research, unethical by any measure. Said one ASTDA member, the ASTDA should add its voice to that of the president and others in expressing their distress and sadness at this unethical set of studies and experiments. We need to reflect on how this could happen and how to assure that it will not happen again. Beyond this, things get a little uneven in terms of how the membership responds or feels that the ASTDA as an organization should respond to our emerging knowledge of these studies. I will focus on three specific areas. First, the culture of experimentation in that specific time, that is the 1940s. Secondly, the involvement of the public health leadership in the extent to which this leadership was aware of and approved the studies, and whether otherwise good people simply made bad decisions. And then thirdly, whether the organization should respond by renaming its most prestigious award. I will address each of these briefly in turn. With regard to the culture of experimentation in the 1940s, some executive committee members have pointed out that these STD studies were actually part of a larger human studies agenda which flourished during World War II and which some investigators took to be part of the larger war effort. These studies extended beyond the field of STDs and addressed diseases which were held to have important military potential in as much as they affect troop wellness and fighting force capability. So the earlier gonorrhea inoculation studies at Terre Haute were actually part of a larger set of intentional exposure experiments addressing dysentery, malaria, influenza, and the like, all of which would probably be considered highly unethical by today's standards, but accepted and understood in their own day as necessary for advancing the American war effort. To paraphrase Reverby, good science against a dreadful disease. In this light, one executive committee member said, times were different during those days. The climate and ethical standard was not what it is today. Another member stated, I have concerns about applying the ethical retrospectoscope. And another member, cautioning against a hasty rush to judgment, asked, what is going on now that will look dubious 20 to 60 years from now? In other words, how will our own work be judged in the future? Personally, I have a problem with dwelling too much on these issues. These studies were simply unethical, then and now. The Presidential Commission, after careful consideration of all the evidence, concluded the Guatemala experiments involved gross violations of ethics as judged not only in light of modern human research ethics, but also against the researchers' own understanding of medical ethics, practices, and requirements of the day. Well, this leads to the second point, the extent to which these studies tarnish the image of the larger public health leadership of the day, and in particular that of Dr. Thomas Perrin. To be sure, the chief villain here appears to be Dr. John Cutler, in collaboration with Drs. Mahoney and Arnold and other members of the Public Health Service Medical Corps. But the Presidential Commission makes clear that far from Cutler being a lone wolf in this endeavor, the final set of experiments was approved at the very highest levels. In fact, the NIH syphilis study section began its work in early 1946, and the Guatemala experiments were among the very first proposals it reviewed and approved. And we saw this picture already. Numerous medical luminaries of the day sat on the panel, names such as Price, Eagle, Heller, Reed, Stokes, and Solomon, representing not only the U.S. Public Health Service and the armed forces, but also such private institutions as Johns Hopkins, Harvard, and the University of Pennsylvania. Most damning of all, final funding decisions were approved by none other than the Surgeon General himself, Dr. Thomas Perrin. Perhaps when the story broke in 2010, ASTDA members could be forgiven for wondering about how much Dr. Perrin was involved in these studies and asking, to paraphrase Senator Howard Baker from the Watergate era, what did he know and when did he know it? However, the Presidential Commission makes clear that Dr. Perrin knew quite a lot. He approved initial funding for the project, was kept apprised of its progress, and, as we know, was alleged to have said, with a merry twinkle in his eye, you know we couldn't do such an experiment in this country. So the Surgeon General made final funding decisions. This is from the Presidential Commission report. And here's the actual quote. This is a letter from G. Robert Coatney, a malariologist, who wrote to Dr. Cutler about Surgeon General Perrin's interest in the work. I saw Dr. Perrin on Friday, February 14th, and at the bottom, a merry twinkle came into his eye when he said, you know, we couldn't do such an experiment in this country. So this is an allegation of what Perrin said. We don't have any direct documents of Perrin's involvement, but I think it's fairly clear that he knew a lot early on. Which raises the final question for consideration here. How do we apprise Dr. Perrin's legacy in light of all we have learned? On the one hand, there is no doubt he is one of the most transformative figures in the STD field, having worked tirelessly to modernize the work of venereal disease control and prevention, as well as to destigmatize these infections in the mind of the public at large. He is so revered that the ASTDA's most prestigious award is in fact named after him, the Thomas Perrin Award for Lifetime Achievement, and has been given annually since 1972 for long and distinguished contributions in the field of STD research and prevention. In light of these findings, can ASTDA continue to feel comfortable about giving the Thomas Perrin Award? Is it time to rename the award, essentially to de-eponymize the organization's most prestigious honor? On this final point, I think it is fair to say the ASTDA membership is divided. About half of the executive committee members I spoke with favor renaming the Perrin Award, and about half favor keeping the name. Analogies abound to historical figures of greater or lesser renown whose important contributions are in some way tarnished by bad things they have done in other aspects of their lives. Thomas Jefferson, for example, gave us the Declaration of Independence. He was also a slave owner and father to Sally Hemings's children. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, was an advocate of the eugenics movement. Can otherwise good people, the argument goes, get caught up in making bad decisions? And at what point is the wrong so wrong that it merits historical revision? As one executive committee member pointed out, some wrongs are less wrong than others and more easily forgiven, especially when the rights appear to put so much weight on the other side of the scale. So where does Perrin fall in all of this? Clearly, this is something the ASTDA membership will need to come to terms with in the near future, as Perrin's role in the Guatemala studies is understood and digested, not only by the association, but those outside the organization, who may indeed wonder what is our position. To continue to honor Perrin as some favor, even in light of the findings of his role in approving the Guatemala studies, may cause reputational harm to ASTDA as it moves forward in advancing its STD prevention and control agenda. But to remove Perrin's name from the award invites questions of why this, why now? Is his wrong so wrong that it outweighs the good he did for our field? That is a question we will continue to grapple with in the coming weeks, months, and years.
Okay, thank you. We have some time, and I've asked my co-speakers and members to come up, and we'll be happy to take questions. Let me again reemphasize Valerie's point that all of this material is available online at the bioethics website, bioethics.gov. Go to studies, and you'll click down, you'll find the Guatemala study. In addition to this material, the material is annotated and linked to the original source documents, including all the correspondence. And this really represents the monumental task that Valerie's staff has performed. Questions? Patrick, do you have any questions?
Hi, Kyle Bernstein, San Francisco.
Kyle, okay.
Assuming that the studies were better conducted, I'm wondering if the panel could comment on the ethics of utilizing the data now to inform syphilis control after not having known that the data existed for a number of years.
Okay. Who went? Paul or Dan?
Yeah. Paul, want to start? Okay. Sure. This is on. This is a recurring question ever since Nuremberg, as you probably know. There were many different studies done at Nuremberg, some of them of very little significance scientifically, others perhaps generating some information that might be useful. And the debate has gone on since then among everyone in the ethics community over whether even recognizing those studies as scientific was wrong. I don't have an answer for that except to say that this is one more line of studies. Tuskegee is another. I've spent many years studying the history of the eugenics movement and can tell you that there are lots of terrific records that are up at Cold Spring Harbor on pedigrees of various diseases which people studying diseases like cancer or Huntington's could use right now. Should they is a question that I think is still unanswered. Fortunately, I think in this case there are enough things that supersede what happened in Guatemala, so that I don't know that anyone scientifically is going to rely on the data there, but I'll leave it to my clinician colleagues to address that.
Dan, anything more to add?
I don't have any more to add. I think that was a reasonable answer.
Okay. Deborah?
I'm Deborah Arundel with the American Social Health Association, but I would like to first make clear that my remarks are not those of the American Social Health Association. It is, I'm sure, for all of us near impossible to process this information with only your head, without both your heart and your stomach being 100% involved as well. I want to say that what we all understand is that the legacy of this is distrust of health systems, are people of color who won't come forth and participate in clinical trials. And these are all things that we know quite well, and that these are legacies that we cannot go back and fix in any way. There are times when we find that there are only very small things that we can do, and these things are, in some ways, perhaps only very symbolic things. So I would, with my heart and my stomach and not my ASHA professional hat, call upon my colleagues at the ASTDA to consider that we are well aware of the many contributions of Dr. Perrin. We are grateful and will always be grateful for the contributions of Dr. Perrin, but our heads and our stomachs and our hearts, when they all come together, at least for me, cries out for at least this symbolic and token gesture by my colleagues, whom I respect and love at the ASTDA. And I apologize for such an emotional response when those of you who work with me know that I do tend to lead with my head. Thank you.
Brad Dealing.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. I think it's fair to say the ASTDA is very upset about this, and to have revered Dr. Perrin for so long and now to have this thrown at us, it's hard for us to digest as well. And as professional researchers, we all deal with issues related to recruiting patients for clinical studies and distrust of the public health system in general. I think to do nothing is the wrong response, and I think that something needs to be done. But I think people need, there's a feeling that there needs to be some open grappling with this and a measure of what are the right and wrong ways to deal with this. And I see Jeannie Marazzo, who's our president, microphone, but certainly something that needs to be addressed openly and transparently so that doing nothing is the wrong thing. I agree with that. Thank you.
Yeah, Jeannie?
Yeah, thanks. I just want to really thank the panel. I think this show should go on the road, and we should really figure out a way to, I think, get this level of discussion out there way beyond the people in this room. This should have been a plenary, and it needs to be, I think, redone many times. So as I was sitting there, I made a long list of comments. I won't go into all of them. And first, I really want to thank the panel. It was an incredible session. But I will quickly say four things. First of all, at a very basic level, it reminds me how hard, or emphasizes how hard it is to name an award after anybody. Because, as we were discussing last night, clearly all of us have things in our life that perhaps we would not want on the front page of the New York Times or in a Twitter feed. So I think it really gives us pause about the whole eponym situation, and also the heroic kind of putting on a podium of people who whose accomplishments, I think, really reflect the efforts of so many unnamed people. I look at my research team and the people who actually do my work, and it's hard to accept an award, or would be hard to accept an award, you know, on the basis of myself alone, because it really is a collective effort to take this off because it's falling off. I think the other thing I wanted to mention is this issue of beneficence, and relates to Kyle's comment about the data. One thing I didn't really hear was this whole issue of failure to publish any of these data. And I think one thing we talk about a lot is that we owe it to our participants to get the word out, given what their contributions have been. And I have problems with researchers who fail to publish even now. You know, I know how hard it is to write papers. I know how hard it is to get it out. But I think failing to actually get anything out of what we've asked these people to do is a really egregious action on the part of researchers. Two other quick things, I guess, is the reactivity of the current environment with regard to research and the pace of information dissemination. I think we need to really take our time and think about this and talk about this a lot. As some of you know, I've been really involved in HIV prevention research, particularly microbicides, and in the last couple of years, and oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, there have been incredibly diverse, divergent findings about the efficacy of these interventions to prevent HIV. And I can tell you, running one of these studies, every time results came out from another study, I got emails and calls and very agitated reactions from people saying, you need to stop your study right now. You need to modify this right now. And then another trial would come out, and I would get the opposite set of emails saying, you know what, you need to do this. So I think that really has bearing on how we conduct studies, how we view what's ethical in the ongoing conduct of trials, and how we react even to something like this. So I think taking a deep breath and really thinking carefully is important. My last comment, I just leaned over to Val and made this observation when you showed the picture of the study section and the fact that they made the decision and sanctioned the decision to do this, to fund this. It really reminded me of the photo of the Republican men who have been making decisions about birth control and women's reproductive rights. And it gets me to this whole concept of who's in charge, because it's really about power. You know that there are plenty of people who were very authoritative and informed who would never have sort of sanctioned the conduct of these experiments, yet the people who had the power got to make the decision, and that's really no different than today. And I think that's an important context to really be aware of. So I really want to thank you again for your effort in coming here. I think it's an incredible event.
Jeannie, I do want to echo one of the comments that you made, and that is on the publication. One of the things that is really amazing, having participated in this process, is to see how, as you've seen, there was this enormous amount of effort put in to these activities between 1946 and 1948. Dr. Cutler published extensively afterwards on Tuskegee, and as well as other things, and there is not a single paper which came out, which clearly raises the suspicion, although Valerie and her staff really looked very assiduously for any documentation. There's strong circumstantial evidence that this was squashed at a very high level, but the smoking gun has never been able to find.
I just want to make one clarification. The serology work was published.
Yeah.
So when we say that there were no publications, we mean with regard to the intentional infection experiment. And the further... I'm sorry. Can you hear me now? I just wanted to make the qualification that the serology work was published, and it was published contemporaneously. The intentional infection or intentional exposure experiments were not published, but for some indirect references over time. There were publications in the 70s that make reference to the information, and the citations are to correspondence 30 years earlier. So it is in the commission's review, we searched up, down, and sideways, and Dr. Cutler seems to have taken efforts to try to get some of the data, the information, into the public discourse, but all of the conventional means which were utilized for other research by Dr. Cutler and others, were certainly not employed in this case for the intentional exposure studies.
Dr. Schachter.
That, of course, is also consistent with the comments about avoiding public scrutiny, mm-hmm. because if you publish, it's public. And that's a comment that I want to make. Our voice is a small one. The SDD community is a very small one. We have one journal that's ours. Obviously, there are other journals in the field. But whatever position ASTDA takes will be published in the journal, and we will provide a forum for discussion by people who want to respond to that. I would like to tell you that I was disgusted by what I read, but I am really grateful to the commission for the job they did in presenting it openly and fairly and revealing something that I obviously knew nothing about. And I knew a number of people sitting around those tables and some of the people who were involved with this. I knew nothing about this, as none of us did until, the revelation. You did a great job. Those of you who represent the commission, thank you.
Thank you.
One last question.
I'm Ralph Wilmoth from Colorado, and I just want to make a general comment. I really do appreciate this presentation, and I felt for a long time that in public health practice community, we don't spend enough time and energy discussing ethical issues, and I think that we need to spend a lot more time and a lot more energy and focus on this topic. Because as someone pointed out in one of the quotes from Dr. Stoner, in 20 years or in 60 years from now, there'll be people reflecting on what we've done and how we make decisions, and some of our very most sincere and intense public health efforts being not the best consideration for the public and the populations we serve. So I just would like to encourage the panelists to do everything you can to get all of us to pay more attention to these issues today and going forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Fenton, do you have any comments? Okay. All right. In the absence of any further questions, we'll call this session to a close. Thank you.
Thank you.